thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a bi-weekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 6 for the 16th of May, 2007, designed to make you think. I'm Dan Cohen. Well, welcome once again to another episode of Digital Campus. We've hit the half dozen mark, and we're going strong. And we also want to remind everyone to encourage people to, of course, they can comment on any podcast online at digitalcampus.tv. Well, I'm here today with the regulars, Tom Scheinfeld from foundhistory.org. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Dan.
And Mills Kelly, of course, from edwire.org. Hey, Mills.
Hi, Dan.
Thanks for joining us once again. And just an editor's note, later on we'll, in the feature segment, we're going to have our first guest. I'm sure the audience is, by this point, after all these weeks, sick of the three of us, right, Tom and Mills? So we're bringing in new blood and actually going to part of our terrific, talented staff at the Center for History and New Media. We'll be talking about web design with Jeremy Boggs, who is our creative lead and sort of senior web developer. So looking forward to that. We want to start off our news segment this week. We have a lot of news to cover, and it seemed to us as we looked over the news from the past couple of weeks that a lot of it involved liberation of formerly cloistered information, information showing up where it shouldn't. And I guess maybe the most interesting, or the one certainly that received the most press, was a story of a student who was about to get her teaching certificate at Millersville University of Pennsylvania, and at the School of Education there. And just days before she was about to graduate, the campus officials discovered her MySpace page, which had her dressed as the drunken pirate. I believe that was the official caption, was it not, Mills?
Yeah, that's the caption for the photograph. She's actually just wearing a pirate hat and drinking from a plastic cup with a Mr. Goodbar logo on it. But the caption of the photograph was drunken pirate.
Okay. And so they denied her this teaching certificate. And what was their rationale for this? Do they not know that people drink? Or is it that it was online? Or what was their problem?
Apparently, they believed that it was sort of conduct unbecoming a future teacher to be seen as a drunken pirate online, and so they decided that they didn't want to be associated with awarding her a degree or a teaching certificate. Not surprisingly, she sued the university for the uncommonly low sum in the United States of only $75,000.
That is surprising.
And what's in some ways... You know, we've talked a lot about social networking in the podcast, and this is one of the negative consequences of it, that when you put things online, everybody can see it. When you put things like this online, everybody can see it, and you have to live with some of the consequences. But, of course, it's unclear whether there was beer in the cup or apple juice in the cup. And also, she was 26 years old or 27 years old
right,
at the time.
Yeah.
So, but from my perspective, in some ways, what's most interesting about it is if you go to the story about this on the Wired Campus portion of the Chronicle of Higher Education, there are almost 150 comments written between the date that the story was posted originally on April 27th and May the 9th. So this is something that clearly touched a nerve with the audience of the Chronicle of Higher Education.
Huh. And were these comments supportive of Stacy or the university? Or
I would say I didn't read them all because there were far too many to read, but just as a sort of skim through, it seems like about 6 or 8 to 1 saying that Stacy got a bad bad deal out of this, and many people were shocked that she was suing for only $75,000. There were a few people along the way saying, you know, there are probably two sides to this story. But and as is the case with information that gets liberated onto the internet, there's lots more available than just this story on the Chronicle, because if you go to thesmokinggun.com, you can not only read more about it, but you can actually read a copy of the official complaint that she filed in the local court in Pennsylvania. And so, you know, now the documentary evidence from this story is beginning to appear online as well. So, you know, nothing is secret anymore.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, we certainly thought of that as, I believe also that this came out on the Chronicle of Higher Ed's blog, but we had seen it before, of course, as professors. This hits a little bit closer to home for us, which is the Academic Careers Wiki, which is making its rounds. I guess this is a rear guard action by the students against the hiring process and the universities. Going in the other direction, these are graduate students who have, I suppose, liberated or found out information, the inside scoop on hiring for professors' slots. Is it just in history, or, I mean, at least
No, it's across the board.
It is. Natural sciences, physical sciences.
Right. And so for those of us, for those of you in the audience who don't know a lot about the academic hiring process, it's still somewhat medieval and also somewhat shrouded. And so oftentimes there'll be, you know, an initial slate of interviews at a major convention like the annual meeting of the American Historical Association. And then usually three or four people will be brought to campus as finalists. And then there's a little bit of a kind of dance that goes on as different universities select, you know, which one of those three or four people they're going to hire. And then, of course, that person might be getting other offers, and there might be all kinds of insider intrigue going on in terms of who gets hired for these positions. And so now all of that information is suddenly being displayed on this wiki site, which is which can be done anonymously, right, Tom?
Yeah, it can be done anonymously. Yeah, and I mean, it seems like a potentially very useful thing, because I mean, sometimes these searches do take a long time, and you know, the deliberations are sometimes endless, and sometimes for good reason. But candidates, I think, do need more information about, and often they're in need of more information about where in the process they stand. Has a decision been made? When is a decision going to be made? And I think the idea is to provide some of that information here through the kind of collective intelligence. The problem with it is it could end up being, you know, just so much sour grapes,
right,
and
sure,
you know, people just kind of going on there and ranting without any real benefit coming out of it.
Right. I mean, it seems like the good part of it is that you're right. We, you know, graduate students often don't hear, and sometimes it can be months before you actually hear what the decision is, because a university might be, you know, still trying to sign their first or second choice, or, you know, they might still be, you know, want to bring further, you know, another slate of possible applicants to campus. And so the process really can take a long time, and you know, you don't hear until the very end, I mean, one way or the other. So I think
it's very different than a kind of an ordinary job where there's maybe a hiring manager or something.
Right, sure.
I mean, these are done by committees, and committees of very busy people who maybe can only get together once every couple of weeks to talk about where the search stands. So
right. I suspect this site is getting a lot of traffic. Someone should capitalize on it.
They've got their Google ads.
They're getting $13.75 a month in Google ads feeds. Well, more on the, I think, up and up as far as we're concerned is a case from that actually was highlighted for me on Creative Commons' sciencecommons.org site. And there was an incident that I saw there about a PhD student, Shelley Batts, who was accused of a fair use violation for pulling a figure in a chart from a scientific paper to post on her blog. So this is someone who was, you know, really just sort of talking about a recent article on her blog. And soon after she did that, she received a cease and desist letter from the lawyers from the Journal of Science of the science of food and agriculture, accused of violating fair use, reproducing material from the journal on her blog, and she actually took down the figures, but went ahead and went through all the trouble, I think, of reproducing the data basically recreating the chart that she wanted to comment on in Excel. And that way sort of got around the fair use provision. But it really did raise for me, because we've thought a lot at the center about, you know, blogs as scholarly entities. And, you know, you would think in that environment you would be able to, from a sort of fair use perspective, certainly comment on a chart or graph. But evidently this is something that's up in the air, at least legally.
And it's, you know, that particular instance raised a question for me about the sort of two questions really about the publishing industry in academia. One is, you would think that this journal would actually be pleased at getting public notice of the journal and perhaps even selling a few more subscriptions or at least reprints of that particular article because someone noted it in their blog. And I can't imagine reproducing one chart created a situation where then no one would be interested in actually purchasing a copy of the article. And so it seems a little misguided to me. But the second question, the sort of the bigger question for me is, if she had written a review in another journal about agricultural science of this particular article and had reproduced the graphic in the review because it was something that needed to be commented on, would they have protested over that? So
right.
Now I think probably not. And I think the issue here is reproducibility. I think they were really worried that because it was in a digital format now.
It was that she sort of grabbed it from some gated database and plopped it onto her blog?
Or just that she scanned it from the journal and plopped it onto her blog. And
right.
I mean, I don't know how she actually put it there, but then once it's there, then anyone could reproduce it very easily. You know, if it's in the printed journal, you can still reproduce it. You can just plop it on your scanner and make a copy and reproduce it, but it's just not quite as easy. And it seems to me that we've gotten a little touchy about certain areas of scholarly communication.
Yeah, well, speaking of... Yeah, go ahead.
Well, no, it seems to me, though, that this journal publisher, I mean, they sort of need to do this. They need to go after people who are, you know, supposedly violating their copyrights, because, I mean, they're in the business of protecting a business model that is really coming to the end of its usefulness. It's really so easy to produce the kinds of materials online now that scholarly journals produce. And they charge enormous sums for subscriptions to these journals. And it just doesn't seem like there's a real long-term business model there unless they really protect their gated materials. So I don't know if I agree with it or not, but I can't say I'm surprised.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm going to cancel my subscription to the Journal of the Science of Food and Agriculture as soon as we get off this podcast.
You know, so am I.
I'm just fed up. in a similar vein, speaking of liberation of materials, there was a story this past week about CrimsonConnect.com, which is a site. I think it was created using NetVibes, which is a sort of easy way to create sort of aggregated web page of information from many other feeds, and you can drop little widgets for weather and things like that. And so a bunch of students at Harvard created a NetVibes website that included things like campus calendar and what student groups are doing. Oh, and also they took the liberty of liberating materials from Harvard's gated courseware platform and putting it up on the site, because, of course, this being a easy-to-access, non-password-required site, a lot of students decided to use Crimson Connect rather than typing in their username and password and seeing what they were supposed to do on the courseware at Harvard. So this was a great way for them to check on their courses as well as what, you know, the crew team was doing, and at the same time, and also see what the weather's like in Cambridge, Mass, and do a search of various events. So savvy students are suddenly liberating all these materials, and I think Harvard was not too pleased with that. Came at the same time, of course, that we saw the launch of Drupal Ed, which goes in the other direction, a sort of open access educational version of Drupal, which is a content management system, and that's available at drupaled.org. And it'll be interesting to see, again, I think, this assault being made on these gated courseware systems. Of course, this happening at the same time. I don't know if the two of you saw Washington Post this morning, but they had a big article on Blackboard, which is, of course, the by far the largest vendor of these systems, gated courseware systems. I think their market cap just went over $1 billion today.
Yeah, again, I think it just, it's sort of all of these stories sort of just show the kind of desperate straits of this, of these business models of gating content. Like, it's just too easy to liberate it. It's too easy for a bunch of, you know, students just to pull down some feeds and throw up a NetVibes page, or use Yahoo Pipes to pull together a whole bunch of content and replicate the kind of functionality that something like Blackboard provides. And there are sophisticated web publishing platforms that are like this new Drupal Ed installation that are being adapted to do a lot of the same kinds of things that that things like Blackboard and WebCT do. And it's just become so easy to do that kind of thing that it just seems, just like with the journal publishing, when it becomes so easy to do it for almost free, it seems like the paid version just ends up having right. real problems.
I do wonder that. Yeah, go ahead, Mills.
Well, what I was going to say is, I think Tom hit the crucial point a few minutes ago when he said a business model that's nearing the end of its life. We're seeing that happen in, at least in history, in the textbook publishing industry. Over the last 4 or 5 months, I've met with a number of representatives of various textbook publishers in European history, and they all tell the same story, which is that sales of textbooks have been falling precipitously, and I see it in my classes. The students just don't buy the textbook anymore. Many of them just don't buy it. And the reason is because they're expensive. They cost, the typical European Western civilization textbook is somewhere between $50 and $90. They're expensive publications. And the students feel like, well, they can just get the same information online, so why spend all that money? And so they just simply refuse. And you could require them to buy the textbook, and they would still refuse. And I think the same thing is going to happen with academic journals, for instance. Organizations, academic societies could require, they require you to buy the journal in order to have access to it if you're not, don't have access through your university library. And sooner or later, academics are going to refuse to subscribe to those journals because there will be free journals online that have content that's just as good or better.
Yeah, I'm not as sanguine as the two of you are that this transition is going to happen very quickly. I mean, at the same time, over the weekend, I heard that Thomson just sold their textbook division mm-hmm. for $7 billion to a private equity firm. Thomson's refocusing on sort of Business News and Reuters and some of the other purchases that they're interested in making. This still seems like an awfully profitable business. And maybe it's just the last throes of it, but I wonder if there's some other friction there that's preventing us from getting to a more open access system. There was also a recent article on OpenCourseWare, MIT's initiative, which is now, I think, reached its fifth year, I believe. 2002, I think, was the launch. And do the two of you know how many American universities have followed suit and are using OCW, the Open Courseware System?
Tell us.
I'm going to guess three.
That's not bad. It's six. It's six. Do you know the number one country for open courseware installations?
No.
China. It has over 150. I think they're moving almost all their major universities to use parts of the open courseware system. So what's wrong with this picture is something that kind of came up in my thinking this weekend about moving to open platforms. There must be some other friction there that's preventing this from happening in the United States.
Well, it seems interesting though that these things that seem to me to be potentially more successful than these as competitors to the big commercial products, more successful than products created by other big institutions, even though they're universities and they're open systems, are these kind of smaller things like a mod of Drupal, which is not designed for education at all, but it can be used for that, or a mod of NetVibes, or a mod of WordPress. Those things to me seem to be the things that may do better in this environment, because they're just so flexible. I think that something like OpenCourseWare has, even though it's free and it's open and whatever, it still has a lot of the same problems as Blackboard, in that it's rigid. It's a kind of big, difficult to use thing. Whereas something like just a Google homepage, and you tell all your students to pull in your feed from a blog to a Google homepage or something, that's just kind of flexible, and different instructors and different scholars can use these things in different ways as they want to, and they can tell their students how to use them in different ways as suits their own purposes. So I think that the real competitors to these big behemoth commercial operations may be kind of smaller, flexible, modded, other kinds of applications.
And I think the other friction is really a generational friction, in the sense that we right now at, you know, in our university, which is has a fairly sophisticated faculty in terms of technology use, still the vast majority of the people here couldn't do any of the things that Tom just said. Instead, they need a system where they can press a button and have an entire course site created for them, and we have an administration to do that. We have we're a WebCT campus, so we have WebCT administrators and their assistant administrators, and so we have a whole infrastructure to make that possible for them. But the generation that's coming along now, the people like our graduate students here and at other places, they will have grown up in this other environment where they can slap up a WordPress site in 25 minutes, and so they're not going to need all of that infrastructure. And at some point, the universities are going to notice that the number of people requesting those services from their administrative staff has been dropping rapidly, at which point they're going to start letting those staff members go, and eventually they'll give up on their WebCT license altogether, which costs I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of dollars a year.
Right.
See, I would be interested to see just how many faculty members at you know, universities that have WebCT or Blackboard subscriptions are actually using them well, or using right. them effectively. Like, I wonder just how push button or turnkey the solution is. I think you're right, Mills, that you know, most faculty members can't set up a NetVibes aggregator, but I think most faculty can't use WebCT effectively either. And so the question is, like, are the universities, and the way WebCT makes its money is not to have all the faculty on campus using it effectively, it's to sell it to a committee of the IT professionals on campus. And I wonder if at some point the IT professionals are going to come around to the realization that, you know, maybe we don't need the subscription for every single faculty member on campus when only a few of them are actually using it to its fullest anyway.
Well, I guess the jury's out. We're definitely going to keep track of this, and I think this is probably the second or third podcast we've discussed it, but certainly a key issue for the next few years to see where this goes. And I hope you're both right. Well, on today's feature, we're sitting down with the creative lead and web developer at the Center for History and New Media, Jeremy Boggs. We have him on Skype. Hey, Jeremy.
Hi.
Welcome to the podcast. You are in a very privileged spot as our first guest.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you on, because I see you so infrequently, considering you're down the hall.
Yeah.
We invited Jeremy on because he's a fantastic web designer. You can see a lot of his work if you go to chnm.gmu.edu and click around. A lot of the beautiful sites there are his handiwork. And we wanted to have him on the podcast to discuss not just web design, but recent trends and web design in academia and libraries and museums. And I guess that's the first question we wanted to ask you, Jeremy, is what are the major trends that you see out there in web design, trends that you think are probably particularly important for people doing web design in higher ed or the museum and library world?
Okay. I guess the biggest trend over the last 5 years or so has been, you know, an increased, you know, attention and focus on web standards of, you know, providing solid semantic markup with HTML, with XHTML, providing styling and design through cascading style sheets, CSS, and also separating behavior with JavaScript. I mean, you know, in the past, all that stuff has been put in the HTML itself. You see inline JavaScript, inline styles, but the last 5 or 6 years, there's been an emphasis on separating those three things to make it more manageable, to make it more accessible to a variety of different users.
Okay. So for people who don't know a lot about web design, I guess your point is that sort of everything, the way that the page looks, the behavior of the page, the content of the page used to be mixed in all together in the same HTML, and now you're saying it's been sort of split up and put in its rightful place?
Right, exactly. I mean, if you look at some really old sites from, I mean, you know, old in this instance is 1998 or, you know, somewhere from the late 90s, you would, if you, you know, looked at the source code for a typical HTML page, you would see font tags, you would see inline style attributes. Like if you want to change the text to a certain style, like if you wanted to change, you know, the font to Arial or something, you would put that inside the HTML instead of putting it in an external style sheet. And the disadvantage of doing that is you would have to do that on every single page of your website, which if you have 100 pages on a website, that's a lot to manage. But by putting it in an external style sheet, you know, the pages themselves will load faster and it's a lot easier to maintain.
And does this mean anything for the look of the page, or how does it affect, you know, how sites actually look and how that's important?
Separating it from, I mean, separating inline styles from, you know, an external style sheet really doesn't affect the look so much. You can still put the same values, you know, inline HTML and in an external style sheet. But what it does is helps you maintain consistency of your look and your feel across, you know, a variety of pages. And if you want to change that, it's really easy to just open up, you know, one single style sheet and to be able to change that one style sheet and it affect your whole site.
Okay, great. And what do you think, if you were to give advice to someone starting out doing web design in, you know, a university setting, it sounds like you would tell them to definitely go with a CSS-based design for maintenance and, you know, ease of change. What else would you say in terms of, you know, key elements of design that you think are really important now in 2007 versus 1997?
Well, I've been really fascinated. Like, in the last couple of months, there's been an increased attention to typographic style on the web. A lot of designers have actually been looking at how we present, you know, text on the screen. You know, you don't just put text up there. You have to think about, you know, line height, spacing, you know, what fonts actually work on the page. And, you know, there's been a lot of different studies or tutorials done on this in the last couple of months that have been really good.
Yeah, I mean, we don't often think about type, and I think a lot of people just go with the default type. Typography makes a lot of difference in the books we read, for instance. We sort of pick up a lot of the message from the kind of font that's used, the layout, and that sort of thing. I mean, it's what separates, say, a scholarly monograph from a very popular work, you know, something that might be in serif versus sans serif, different kinds of fonts. They really do have a big impact, don't they? Sort of.
Right.
And oftentimes on a kind of subconscious level.
Yeah. I mean, one of the bad things, I think, well, it's not bad, but whenever I read a book now, you know, the first thing I look at is, okay, you know, how wide is the text on this, in this book? Have they actually laid out the type in a way that, you know, is more legible? You know, I'm actually critiquing, you know, the design of the book more than actually, you know, the contents of the book itself.
Hmm.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That too much, but. You know, it seems like for the past, well, I guess 500 years or so, the actual production of scholarly material, of intellectual content, the production of it and the distribution of it has been really separate from the intellectual work itself. With the book, where, you know, we sit down, we write the book, either longhand or we use a word processor now. But when the book is then produced, we hand it over to somebody else, and that person has all of the expertise of typography and layout and design. And we kind of just leave that to others. Now, with the advent of the web, it seems like some of that work, some of that skill, is thrown back on the scholar. Right. And we're in this kind of uncomfortable position that we probably haven't been in since the transition from manuscript to print, of having to know something about design. And I don't think a lot of humanists, or really scholars of any stripe, think about design very much at all.
No, you're right. I don't think they... and you know, I've thought a lot about this. I mean, it seems to me that a lot of academics think of design as, you know, merely decoration. I mean, this is one of, you know, David Staley's arguments in his book, Computers, Visualization, and History, that, you know, academics, we tend to think of, you know, pictures and, you know, fonts as, you know, simply decoration and not also as a way to convey information, to convey an argument. And for me, doing web design, we're already, like, as academics, we're already thinking about user interface. I mean, the way we present text in a book, the way we organize the text in a book, if we want to move a sentence, you know, in the middle of the paragraph, if we want to move paragraphs around, the way we title paragraphs, this is all, you know, information architecture. This is all user interface. A book is a user interface. And so, you know, I think it's really beneficial for academics to start thinking in that sense, or to be aware of that, that we're really already doing that when we write text, when we write a manuscript, and to apply that to web design.
So, Jeremy, what you know, since web design can be kind of complicated, are there some shortcuts? I mean, do you recommend, let's say, to a scholar just starting out to use, you know, a platform like WordPress or something that already has some design built in that they can kind of tweak? What would you say to a kind of new user or an institution that doesn't have a web development team like we do?
For someone who doesn't have a web development team, I definitely think a hosted service like WordPress or Typepad would be a really good way to get, you know, a digital history project started. I mean, it's completely free. You don't have to have, you know, a strong sense of design. It's, you know, it has a lot of templates and, you know, ways to change the look of your site. But it's also a really easy entryway into doing digital history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would second that. I actually in March taught a workshop to some master teachers in Cambodia, and I used WordPress as the platform for teaching them how to get started. And, you know, it took 2 days for them to have websites built. And these are people with zero web experience other than just using the internet to search for information or send an email.
Yeah. I've done the same thing with my students in my History 120 class. You know, I've told them to sign up for, you know, a WordPress blog and then, you know, show them, you know, small things to do with HTML, like how to embed a YouTube video. And it's, you know, at some level it's empowering for them to be able to learn, you know, step by step how to do things like that. And I think, you know, hosted services like, you know, WordPress and Typepad, you know, allow people to do that without, you know, the intimidation of, you know, writing code by hand.
What do you, speaking of user interface, a lot of the, you know, the books that are out there on web design talk about, you know, making everything really easy to use. And so you have giant buttons for everything. And there are books with titles like, who is it? Steve Krug's book, Don't Make Me Think. Which to an academic is a frightening thing to say. where do you come down on web design in terms of this? I mean, do you have to have a giant button that says, you know, enter the museum exhibit online here, or are there more subtle things you can do? Where do you stand? I mean, and most, you know, speaking of the book as a technology, I mean, most academic books are, they're very dense. There's not a lot of, you know, big red buttons in our book. So how do you kind of square those two things?
I mean, it's a really interesting tension, I think. I mean, when I was doing my minor field statement for Roy Rosenzweig, I actually addressed Steve Krug's title. His title is Don't Make Me Think. The title of my minor field statement was, But I Want You to Think. And so I was thinking about, you know, how to do this. You know, in Krug's defense, he's really talking about not making users think about where information is on the web. I mean, it would be, you know, really disconcerting to buy a book that has a table of contents, but none of the titles in the table of contents match the titles of the chapter in the book. Or they don't make sense. They don't relate. I mean, that's partly what Krug is talking about.
Right. And that happens a lot on websites, and a lot of that academic actually, websites.
That does happen quite a bit. Part of that, not getting users to think, or really the whole point is getting them to think about what you think is important, what your message is for your website, what content you want to present. There's a really big value with Web 2.0. One of the, you know, the strong, I guess, facets of Web 2.0 is content is king. Like, it doesn't matter how the user gets the content. The point is they should be able to access the content, understand it, and apply it in some way, you know, in their life. And, you know, I think good design should facilitate that.
Another area that I think a lot of us, you know, have trouble with is, because we don't have much training in it and we're not very artistic, is color. And I think you've done a lot of really interesting work with applying color to websites and thinking about how that fits in. What's your philosophy there? And, how would you sort of communicate that to a new user?
My philosophy with color is pretty much my philosophy with anything that I do with web design, whether it's typography or color or layout or, you know, animation or graphics or anything like that, is to, first of all, figure out, you know, what is your topic, what is your message that you want to convey to users. And then, I mean, color's really interesting. I mean, everyone has their own favorite colors. Everybody, you know, thinks that a certain color fits with a certain topic and other colors don't. So, I mean, there's really no science to it. It's a lot of kind of feel and attitude. And I don't know, that's really not a very good answer, but that's the best one I can think of. There's a lot of good books. Molly Holtschlag, who writes at molly.com, she's a very prominent web designer, very important proponent of web standards, wrote a book recently on color. It's called Color for Websites, very appropriately called. And she talks a lot about color theory, you know, which colors go well together. There are tons of books written on color theory, on how to match colors properly, things like that, that, you know, we could spend a whole other podcast talking about.
Sure.
But I would start with her book, and I would, you know, do some searches on the web for, you know, applying color to websites.
But I would also say that I think it's really important that not only should the color match the tone or the content of the project, but also that there's a serious issue about accessibility. I mean, you know, red and green together causing problems for people who are colorblind. There are, you know, certain colors that are of type that are hard to see against other backgrounds. And so when we're thinking about design, we also have to think about accessibility. Have you spent much time thinking about accessibility issues, Jeremy?
I've thought a lot about accessibility. That's probably one of my bigger that's one of my main goals, like working with the centers to make sure our sites are as accessible to as many people as possible. And you're right, color is definitely an important factor in that, and that a lot of people don't think about. There's actually some, you know, good resources that on the web that if you, you know, send them your URL, they'll check your site to see, okay, you know, which users will be able to read this text based on the kind of, you know, color blindness that, that they have. That, and it's really, you know, enlightening. There's actually one site, I can't remember which one it is now, but you can actually put the URL to your site, you know, in the form, and it'll generate images of your site based on, you know, what a user would see that has, you know, specific color blindnesses.
Oh, that sounds great. Well, we'll get that link from you and add it to the to the show notes for sure. What other sites do you look at other than Mali.com that you think would be helpful?
I subscribe to – what's really interesting is when I started blogging in, like, 2004, I didn't start blogging because of all the history bloggers. I started because of all the web design bloggers. I was really fascinated at how the community was really self-sacrificing. They really wanted to help each other out. They weren't, you know, interested in, you know, getting their name out there or anything like that, which, considering how competitive academia can be, it was, you know, really kind of refreshing. A couple of blogs that I read are a couple of really good designers. There's a guy named Dave Shea from Canada. He writes at mezzoblue.com. mezzoblue.com. Dan Cederholm, he's a really prominent designer. He's worked on ESPN.com, MTV. He's brought all those sites up to, you know, web standards. He's made them more accessible. He blogs at simplebits.com. There's Eric Meyer's blog, meyerweb.com. Eric Meyer is the probably the lead expert at CSS, the language itself. Those are a couple of them.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And that sounds great. And we'll again, we'll link to all those from digitalcampus.tv. Where do you see things heading in the next, let's say, 5 years in terms of web design? It sounds like CSS was a pretty major revolution in the way the web is designed and implemented and updated. Are there other things like that coming down the pike that our audience should be aware of?
One thing that's really interesting is with the development of CSS, like the first spec, CSS 1, came out in 1996. And then CSS 2, which were were some additions to the language, that came out in 1998. But CSS 3 has been in development for the last 10 years, and it hasn't been finalized as a spec. So, I mean, there have been a few designers who have kind of criticize this and wonder where the development of CSS is headed. I'm not really sure if CSS 3 will ever be, you know, adopted as a standard and then implemented by browsers.
Right. It seems like a lot of these standards things, like HTML5, has been taking years and years and years. So,
right.
There's a lot of stakeholders. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of concern from, you know, accessibility experts about, you know, changes in HTML5. There was recently, you know, a couple of tags that were intended to be, you know, helpful for accessibility were voted down, and you know, a lot of people have been, you know, criticizing the work group. You know, I'm really not sure where that's where HTML5 is going to be heading in the next year or two.
Right, right.
But I definitely think that's something to look out for.
Uh-huh. And how about all these AJAX sites and kind of dynamic design where it looks more like Flash or video type applications that are occurring right in the browser? That seems to make things even more complicated for someone just starting out.
It definitely makes things more complicated. What's great about a lot of those sites is they're adhering to the philosophy I was talking about earlier, you know, separating content from your presentation, from your browser, or from your behavior. I mean, you have those three different, you know, kind of fields of programming with web development. And I think AJAX has actually helped, you know, bring that about. You know, in the late 1990s, there was a lot of, you know, DHTML libraries and a lot of inline JavaScript that would do some really cool things, but if you didn't have JavaScript, you know, enabled, you couldn't use it. And the trend now is to have those, you know, enhancements available for people who do have JavaScript, but to have something to fall back on if it doesn't.
Right. Huh.
And I think that'll continue, you know, into the next, you know, 5 or 6 years, hopefully.
Great. Well, thanks. This has been a great roundup of what's going on. And again, I encourage everyone to check out Jeremy's work, not only on our site, but also on his really terrific blog, which is at clioweb.org. That's CLIOWEB.org. And how long have you been blogging for, Jeremy?
Since 2004, August 2004.
That's great. You're definitely the first one at the center who started it all off. Yeah. I think we now probably have 15 bloggers or something, but Jeremy was there first, and it's a terrific blog. So I encourage our audience to take a look at that. And thanks again, Jeremy, for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you, Dan.
As with every episode, we love to end the show with a few links and go around the virtual roundtable and see what the three of us have found online that we think our audience would find interesting, useful, resources, technologies, programs, etc. Mills, why don't we start with you this week?
All right. Well, mine is it's a Google Earth community called History Illustrated, and this is a place where for Google Earth users, people post various overlays that they've created for Google Earth, and many of them in this particular group, the History Illustrated group, they're historic. And so, you know, a couple that I've looked at are one of the first transatlantic cable. You can see it laid out across the Atlantic, but you know, and also one that I think is really topical is someone created an image overlay for Greensburg, Kansas, the town that was destroyed by a tornado a couple of weeks ago. And so you can see, you know, Greensburg today, and you can see maps of what the town looked like before the tornado. So, and there are maps of aerial photographs of the Bismarck just before it set out on its last voyage in the Second World War and things like that. So it's a place where people have posted all sorts of really interesting overlays, and you see lots of visual representations of historic content on the map, and so it's a fun place to see the kinds of things that amateur historians are really interested in. And I would give you the URL, but it's way too long to read out. So,
right. Well, give us another chance to plug everyone going to our site and commenting on our episodes. So we'll put that on digitalcampus.tv, and you can go look up the episode, and we'll have it in the show notes. Tom, what did you find for this week?
Yeah, I've got another long URL, so I'll put it in the show notes as well. It's from a blog called I'd Rather Be Writing at idratherbewriting.com, but the actual URL of the post is pretty long. It's a post called 20 Usability Tips for Your Blog, and it's condensed, as the author Tom Johnson says, from dozens of bloggers' experiences. I don't know which bloggers these are. But there are 20 principles for how you should organize, design, maintain your blog. And, you know, I went through and I maybe was able to check off like 12 of them. So I'm going to spend the next weekend fixing my blog to maybe meet the last eight. But it just gives a sort of a checklist of things that if you're a blogger, which I assume, you know, many people in our audience are, if you're a blogger, things that you should be doing that maybe you're not doing, or things that you could be doing better if you're trying to gain audience or improve your visibility. So 20 usability tips for your blog.
Great. Okay. Well, we'll click on the link in the show notes. Well, apropos to our discussion earlier in the show in the news roundup, I wanted to to tell everyone about a new site that's been posted called the Directory of Open Access Journals. At doaj.org. It's run by the Swedes, I think, National Library of Sweden and some other organizations, although it seems to also have funding from EBSCO and some generally closed or gated material sponsors. But it has 2,600 open access journals in a directory, and you can actually search many of them at the article level. There's well over 100,000 open access articles, and these are articles and journals in almost any field. There are actually 99 history journals, many of which I had never heard of before. And actually, if there's a history journal editor out there or owner out there, if you register now, you could be the 100th open access history journal on doaj.org. again, thinking about our discussions of open versus closed access, this is a great place to head over to and just see all the content, scholarly content that's out there for free, fully available on the web at the Directory of Open Access Journals. Well, again, thanks for joining us for Episode 6 of Digital Campus, and we'll be back in 2 weeks with more news stories, a new feature, and more links. We'll see you then.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do.